Mr. Mason, ring four.
And I could understand them being in sympathy with the communists, who, of course, promised them that things would be better, you know, when peace came. For those villagers, things could never have been any worse. And this, of course, is where communism makes its mark, on the basis that you've got nothing to lose but your chains. At the same time, many of the younger people had no idea, that is, the Greeks knew nothing about communism, really. They just thought life would be better, as they'd been promised, if they joined Elas, Ayam and the Indates generally, and helped to liberate the country. So as I say, I certainly wasn't sort of anti-communist. For the poor people that had suffered under the royalists and the previous administration, the autocratic rule of the royal family and the near fascism of Metaxas, the president, just before the war, at the start of the war. And for the ordinary Greek peasant, he was heartily glad to see the back of all of them. Anything would be better than his past life. I've been back into those mountains several times over the last few years, and I must say, things haven't changed, whatever government's been in power. There's still awful poverty there. Many, many of the young people, of course, leave those villages and go down into the towns to work, find jobs. They won't stay up there and scratch a living in the mountains. But then that applies, I suppose, to many countries in Europe today. The younger people won't stand the lives, the way of living that their parents had known.
Were you always working yourself with AM and ALAS, guerrillas?
Yes, yes.
No other groups?
No. And it was a strange thing, you see, that mainly the British missions who were with those ALAS and AM groups had a certain sympathy for them and for their aims. And after all, they were the only people who offered any real resistance. And you find this in many countries, that the communists in France, for instance, in Poland, they were the main resistance people, in Italy too. They were the main organized resistance to the Germans. You find this everywhere. As far as I could see, the royalists sort of sat back and waited for the war to end and hoping that they will once again, you know, take power and life would be exactly as it was before for them. And I suppose when you think about it, this is the human way of thinking, isn't it?
Were you able to have discussions with the Greek guerrillas?
Oh, many times, yes. I mean, some, you know, I say many times, some spoke English. We got on quite well with the individuals. In fact, we got on very well with most of them. Their political commissars we had no contact with, or at least I had no contact with. They were the usual teachers, you know, they were the leaders, the political leaders. In every guerrilla band, there would always be a civilian political boss, as it were. He made the speeches and in a true communist fashion. They were always having political plays and discussions and so on. Every village you went to, they'd set up a stage and they'd get these various actors to perform, as they did in many other countries, to brainwash the locals into communist way of thinking.
What were the prayers about?
Oh, the political past mainly. You know, the awful police and the awful politicians that ground the faces of the poor, you know, and the usual thing repeated over and over again. And of course their own political aims, that life would be better for everybody, usual story, you know. Usual communist story. Well, the usual, everyone's political story, the politician's story, that life will be better under us. I mean, this is the whole meaning of politics. No one will ever get up and say, well, life will be worse under us. It'll always be better under this party or that party or someone else's party.
How did these players and propaganda go down with the villagers?
Well, you never really knew. I suppose they clapped in the right places and laughed in the right places, but I think most of it went over the villagers' heads, especially the older ones. They really didn't understand what was going on. All they were interested in is where the next bit of food was coming from, it seemed to me, for themselves and for their children, because during the winter of 43-44, I mean, they're in desperate straits. I mean, food for us was hard to find. I mean, we were more or less living off the country. We had a few spare rations tucked away in various caches around the area, but we didn't get to those too often, so we lived mainly as they did on, maize bread and olives, cheese, bit of goat meat occasionally. There wasn't much spare food around, and people were hungry, I mean, and starving. Some were starving and dying of starvation too in certain places in Greece. Not in our particular area. You see, the communists could commandeer in the towns through their agents and so on, and they always got this sort of bare essentials of food. They always seemed to be able to dish out the rations. And of course we were supplying, don't forget, we were supplying them with hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of gold, which was dropped into us for distribution. And that gold on the black market bought an awful lot of food, and which is what they used it for, you see. I mean, we, for instance, weren't allowed to say to a shepherd, sell us a lamb, and there's a sovereign. I mean, that was strictly against all the communist rules. They could buy, in the towns, they could buy the flour and perhaps rice or perhaps meat or even tin stuff and get it back up into the mountains. And then that was distributed. The only thing we had which was different was occasionally when we had a drop of supplies, we had certain comforts dropped into us, perhaps occasional bottles of scotch and a few sweets, tobacco, cigarettes and that sort of thing. Not much in the way of food as such. So we mostly lived as they did. And we found, of course, that when I went in October, there was quite a lot of fruit around, there seemed to be quite a lot of corn. People were looking fairly fit, but as the winter dragged on, and of course it can be bitterly cold in the mountains of Greece, and food got scarcer, then there just wasn't enough to go round. But it was the actual weight of food that was the difficulty, dropping in food supplies. I believe on occasions we got sacks of rice dropped into us, and we didn't see much of it. That was distributed amongst the communist LRCM forces. Clothing, that got very short. And of course, during that bad period, It was difficult for the aircraft to fly and to find the dropping zones, perhaps covered in snow and lots of cloud and rain and that sort of thing. So although perhaps the food and the supplies were back in the Middle East, it wasn't that easy to get the stuff dropped in.
Why did the communists forbid the buying of lambs from shepherds?
Well, they forbade us buying, the British buying them, you see, because we were supposed to live as they did. I mean, and abide by their rules and their laws. And we couldn't appear, really, to be doing something that they didn't approve of, which was understandable, really. I mean, they couldn't have the English lords, as it were, sitting up and they're eating the best while their men were hungry. It wouldn't have been done, wouldn't have been allowed. I mean, we wouldn't have wanted to be seen doing that, or do it, you see. So more or less we did live as they did. I think that was reasonable, that was quite fair.
Did you feel much privation?
Personally, not a lot. It's a strange thing, we were all pretty fit in those days. We didn't seem to go, I suppose we were hungry part of the time, but you tend to forget, you know, hunger is followed by perhaps a good blowout of goat meat and bread, and you feel that's fine for another week, you know. But then in those days, I don't think that we sort of concentrated on food and drink as we do today. In fact, I can't remember too much about, you know, food at all, meals.
Were there women with the guerrillas?
Yes, there were indeed. Yes.
Were you forbidden to have anything to do with them?
Oh, pretty well, yes. And the communists were too. I mean, the men, of course, were. The women guerrillas were untouchables. As a matter of fact, in the village of Mavreli, there was a training place for these girl guerrillas, as we called them. And they were uniformed eventually, and quite smart they looked. They acted, although they were drilled with rifles and that sort of thing under an instructor. I've got a couple of quite good pictures of these village girls in my album. They were very shy about me taking a photograph of them, and I had to get permission from the instructor before he'd allow me to take a photograph. And it is just a little bit unusual. But, oh yes, they were well disciplined, and I should say there was absolutely no sexual conduct at all, you know, sort of misconduct between them. It just would not be allowed.
Why were they shy of photographs? Because of modesty or security?
Yes, modesty mainly. Now, one of the things, you see, the village women always wore their dresses, black dresses, always black dresses, right down to their ankles. And even young girls of, say, 14 or 15, when they'd reached that age, they also wore their dresses down to their ankles. Now, when these guerrilla girls appeared in uniform, in trousers, battle dress, tops and trousers, the village women were absolutely appalled. They would hide their eyes if a group of these girls passed them. Because never had the women sort of shown anything but this long skirt. I mean, to see an evening trousers, a woman's crotch, would be absolutely against all their laws. Just wouldn't allow that, you see. And they were appalled, the women, to see their daughters in these trousered uniforms. I don't suppose they'd have minded if they'd have worn. If they'd worn long khaki skirts, but to see them in actual trousers was frowned upon, even more than frowned upon.
But the women and girls themselves didn't mind.
They didn't seem to mind. They didn't seem to mind. They all seemed a bit shy, you know. And I think this was the one of the reasons why they didn't much care to have themselves photographed. I'm sure you that. You'll see the expressions on their faces.
What military jobs were they supposed to do?
Well, mainly humping and carrying and a bit of nursing and that sort of thing, you know, cooking. The general sort of run of things that women soldiers do, I suppose.
Shooting and
well, if called upon, they would they were trained to use rifles, yes. And I suppose if called upon, they would have stood their ground and fired with the best of them, you know, if they'd been attacked. I don't remember any of them taking part in an attack on the train jobs or anything like that. But then I don't think they were around at that time. It was only later that they appeared. There were always a few women amongst the bands, older women, helping out, you know, with the cooking and the bread making particularly and things like that. And soap making, that was always a woman's job in the mountains, you see. Soap was very hard to find. And they used to set up these, I don't know what you'd call them, but they were devices for making soap from goat fat and lye. This stuff used to be, these things used to be in every village and they used to make this horrible sort of lye soap, and this was one of the women's jobs. You couldn't buy soap, and no soap was ever dropped into us, as far as I know.
Did you have any bodily infestations?
Yes, I did, yes. And that was a thing that I can stand most things, but I can't stand being lice infested. And I was, on the occasion after we'd blown this train on Christmas Eve, Major Scott and I went to a bothy to have a couple of hours rest before we tackled the rest of the mountain. And I'm sure it was there that we both got lice infested, because with the sheep and the shepherds in their clothes. And then for about 3 weeks I was absolutely smothered in lice. And of course I'd hate the things. I think to be lice-ridden is one of the worst things you can be. With no way of getting rid of them, that was the point, and no other clothes to change into. And it must have been 3 weeks or a month later, and I was stripped right down to a battle dress and a battle dress top, because my other stuff was so lice-ridden. I tried to kill them in freezing cold water, and I tried to burn them, but only succeeded in burning the clothes. And then eventually, when we got to Descarte, there was a big drop arrived, and I was then able to really strip off and shave and get most of the hair off my body, get rid of these lice, and then completely change my clothes, you know. Everything was changed, boots, socks and the lot. Which was lovely. And funny enough, I did get them again. I sort of kept clear of bothies and sheepfolds and things like that, because I think that's where they found them. I watched out for them in the future.
Did the Greeks come to you for medical assistance?
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, because the Greek peasant always thought that the British, every one of us, were both doctors and virtually millionaires. They looked upon us as being always very rich, because they were so poor. Even, you know, other ranks, sergeants, whatever, they thought we were rich. I suppose we were compared to them. But they all thought we were trained doctors, or at least trained, you know, nurses or had medical knowledge. And they were often coming in for asking us for medicine. Of course, one of the biggest illnesses around there was malaria, especially amongst the children. And you'd see the kids with great swollen spleens, you know, absolutely riddled with malaria. And quinine was the greatest thing that they wanted, you know. But quinine was, one of the things we didn't have. Although there again, it was bought from the Germans on the black market, down in Tricola and Larissa. I can see these little red packets coming into our station, and they were dished out, but you needed tons of the stuff to treat everybody.
You told me a story earlier about how you treated somebody's hand with sulfonamide.
Yes, well this, I was on my own in the village on this occasion, and this old man, well he wasn't so old, came in to the mission hut where we were, our house, and showed me his hand when he undid these filthy bandages. And I was surprised to find leaves sticking to his flesh, or what flesh was left on his fingers. And I knew that the sulfonamide powder would do miracles, so I cleaned him as best I could, got all the leaves off. He couldn't speak a word of English, of course. I couldn't speak much Greek in medical terms, if any at all. So I cleaned him up as best I could and gave him liberal doses of this powder and bound him up with a clean bandage and gave him some more powder to use, which he promised he would. And he went on his way quite happy. Didn't seem to be in a great deal of pain. And a week or so later he came back into the village and I saw him and asked to look at his hand. And I saw his nails were growing again and flesh appearing, and he looked fine. The hand seemed to be so much better. But he was still using these leaves, and he swore to me that the leaves had done the trick and not my powder. What leaves they were, from some tree or other, a local cure for something, but I don't think they would have stopped his hand rotting away. I'm sure that powder did the trick for him. Quite remarkable stuff, really.
So you didn't get any credit for it?
Not a lot. Not a lot.
What did you think of the leadership which the guerrillas had with whom you came into contact?
Well, very mixed. Very mixed. They didn't appear to be overall leaders. They wouldn't take responsibility. It all had to come from above, from some committee and then another committee until we got back to the main committee, and consequently everything they did had to be discussed endlessly before any moves could take place with regard to an action. Those people that blew the bridges there in the first instance know all about this. The cooperation was so appalling. Some groups would go along and help. Others had to get permission, or they'd have to discuss it, or they would have to discuss it with a higher authority and then another higher authority. No one seemed to take overall responsibility for any action that took place, and I think this was galling to the British who were helping, the Allied officers and so on, who were helping them. No one would make decisions. And consequently, there was so much talk went on, arguing back and forth about the merits of this case and that case. And our people, I think, got heartily sick of them. It was a wonder to me that the RCO, Chris Woodhouse, had so much patience with them. He understood the Greeks very well indeed, but I think even he on occasions lost his patience and cool with the communist leadership or so-called leadership. As I said, he was a marvellous speaker of the language and could speak it probably better than most Greeks. And he used to lay into them at times, because they would not make decisions and cooperate. And I've heard him berating these leaders, but they just took it and said, well, the famous Greek word, teithokanomi, what can we do? What can we do? And you heard this constantly. They were frightened stiff of doing anything that their bosses thought, you know, was not the thing to do. And don't forget, I mean, as far as those communists were concerned, they were dealing with pure capitalists, you know, that was us. And for them, we were beyond the pale.
Did you come across any hostility from them?
Not really. Oh, no, no. More respect than anything else. I mean, they used to put on this act, you know, or you've got so much, we've got so little. You know, but then this is the communist teaching, isn't it? You know, the capitalists and their running dogs and all this sort of thing. They've been at this for years. How the capitalists take from the poor and so on and so forth. And we were looked upon as the capitalists taking, not from them, from the poor of our country. I mean, they considered all of us capitalists. I mean, the lowest of us were considered capitalists. Never mind our political views. But British and American were capitalists. The Russians were their brothers. And they were communists.
Did they try to convert you politically?
Oh, no. No, well, they'd have a job. No, they didn't really. Oh, you got lectures from various people, you know, you got the sort of the teacher who spoke a bit of English, who tried to point out the faults of capitalism, obviously, and the wonders of communism. But, of course, as we used to say, well, we've heard it all before. But there was no actual serious conversion, no.
What impression did you get of the attitude of the average Greek villager towards the Germans?
Hate. Hate and respect. Strangely enough, more hate towards the Italians, who were, of course, in control before the Germans took over. Now, they really did hate Italians because they were an ill-disciplined army, and in many cases they were worse than brigands themselves, who used to rob and steal and kill, as far as the Greeks were concerned. The Germans were more disciplined. They were afraid of the Germans. I wouldn't say they hated the Germans, not as much as they hated the Italians. When I say they respected them, they still do, for their efficiency. And they never seemed to blame the Germans if, for instance, they came up and wiped out their homes and their villages. They thought, in their way, well, all right, you know, we've asked for it, and they've done it, and this is it.
They thought that there was a certain rightness about it.
Yes, they respected them for their power.